Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The La Niña weather system has ended, UN weather experts said on Tuesday, adding that the cooler global temperatures it is associated with are unlikely to last. World Meteorological Organization spokesperson Claire Nullis reported that neutral conditions are now likely to dominate the tropical Pacific for the next few months. Air temperatures are expected to be above average between June and August, especially in the northern hemisphere, she said. The development is significant because the 2020 Atlantic hurricane season had a record-breaking 30 named storms, many of them devastating to low-lying communities. La Niña refers to the large-scale cooling of the ocean surface temperatures in the central and eastern equatorial Pacific Ocean, coupled with changes in the tropical atmospheric circulation, namely winds, pressure and rainfall. It usually has the opposite impacts on weather and climate as El Niño, which is the warm phase of the El Niño Southern Oscillation. To Ethiopia's Tigray region, where the World Food Programme, or WFP, on Tuesday said that it has embarked on a new round of humanitarian deliveries to mainly vulnerable women and children, some of the 5.2 million people at risk. Emergency food assistance from the UN agency has now reached 1 million people since distribution started in northwestern and southern zones of Tigray in March. The UN agency intends to scale up operations to reach 2.1 million in the region where fighting erupted last November between central government forces and regional power brokers loyal to the former national ruling party. This week's target aid districts in Tigray's southern zone are Korem and Ofla, where WFP expects to assist around 80,000 people of the 200,000 who are most in need. Speaking in Geneva, WFP spokesperson Thompson Feary underscored the disturbing results of new food insecurity assessments.
We are seeing rising levels of malnourished women and children. According to the Nutrition Cluster, which is a grouping of agencies who are working in nutrition, almost half of the pregnant or nursing mothers in 53 villages were either moderately or acutely malnourished.
The millionth person to collect food aid was Asta Bayene from Adimilan, a remote rural village 50 kilometers from Shire in northwestern zone. The 43-year-old mother of seven lost both her home and crops 2 months ago to conflict. She said that until now she'd been forced to rely on handouts from neighbors, but that the wheat, split peas and vegetable oil that she received would finally provide some relief from the hunger her family had been suffering. The UN agency UNHCR on Tuesday urged greater support for the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines to developing nations, and in particular to the Asia-Pacific region, which shelters the vast majority of refugees. The appeal comes as coronavirus cases and deaths continue to surge in the region, which has received only a fraction of the world's COVID-19 vaccines. Refugees are especially vulnerable to the spread of the virus because they often live in overcrowded settings with limited water and sanitation facilities, which can contribute to increased infection rates. UNHCR spokesperson Andrew Mahechich said that in the past 2 months, Asia-Pacific nations have experienced the largest increase in the number of cases globally, with some 38 million recorded infections and more than 500,000 deaths. Humanitarian agencies were doing what they could to protect vulnerable people, including refugees in 145 countries where UNHCR works, Mr. Mahechich said, but preventive measures could only go so far.
We have done all the legwork that we could for the procurement of the equipment for the frontline workers, for the volunteers, for the people who might be at the higher risk of exposure to the virus. Now, obviously, these measures need to go hand in hand with the vaccinations in order to prevent the populations that are currently very vulnerable. And what we are seeking is not a preferential treatment, but an equitable access according to the criteria that has been set also by the WHO in terms of what are the vulnerable categories.
The UNHCR spokesperson reported that in Cox's Bazar refugee camps in Bangladesh, which are home to nearly 900,000 ethnic Rohingya, the number of COVID-19 cases has increased considerably in the last 2 months, but not a single vaccine has been administered because supplies are so scarce in the country. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alice Smith. Post-growth and degrowth, Tim Jackson and Laurent Kieser.
Good lives do not have to cost the earth.
The stock markets, banks, every business and every person wants to grow more and buy. Will we wait for the great collapse or plan our way back down the mountain?
From the UK, Professor Tim Jackson talks about his new book, Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. Lawrence Keeser from Zurich takes it further, degrowth plan decline coupled with increasing well-being.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you!
The pandemic, jobs crash, weird politics, these are strange times. If we're all twisting into a new society, maybe, could it be better? Right up to the minute comes out a new book from respected economist Dr. Tim Jackson. It is called Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. Tim Jackson is professor of sustainable development and director of the Center for Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. After serving as economist advising the UK government on sustainability, Tim's book Prosperity Without Growth made a bit of a splash and made a few people cranky. Oh, and Tim's other hobby is writing plays for the BBC. Tim Jackson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's a huge pleasure to be with you.
Well, the book is not what I expected. There are no formulas and balance sheets in here. You're an economist, for God's sake. I wanted your solution for the future. Instead, we find a box of lives and what life means. But maybe that is what economy really should be about.
Well, I think that was part of the point that I was making. I mean, if you want those solutions, they're kind of hidden there in Post-Growth. They're much more explicit, actually, in Prosperity Without Growth, the book that you mentioned, which was written for a policy audience. It was written, as you said, for the UK government. And indeed, it did ruffle a few feathers because it dared to think about questioning economic growth. One of the strange things about that book was actually not how poorly received it was by the government that it was written for, but how well received it was by a much wider audience, a wider audience who didn't really want formulae, didn't even sometimes want charts and figures, didn't need to understand economics as a set of equations, but could understand economics as a set of stories. And that's really what I tried to do in Post-Growth, was to tell some of those stories and to relate them to human beings and to provide what I think is this enormous resource, a resource of the thinking of generations of wise women and men who could actually help us at this point in time to shape an economy that's fit for purpose and give us some sense of our journey out of the crisis of the last year.
Yes, it's time to call the ghosts of our elders. We're in trouble.
I guess you could put it that way. And sometimes the very real presence of our contemporary younger generation, who I also call on from time to time in Post-Growth.
In 2010, you delivered a TED Talk. I don't know if you're aware of it, but you got over 200,000 views on YouTube on that, and it's still building.
I think actually on the TED site itself, it may even be more than that, because TED sort of embeds itself in various different ways. Yeah, it has had a lot of views, and it's quite strange that people still like it, talk about it, and refer to it. You know, in a way, that TED Talk, I was trying to do a very similar thing. I was trying to kind of make our dilemmas accessible to people and to relate it to stories about our lives and to offer people an alternative, a sense that there is actually a way to build progress, social progress, in a sense that's meaningful for ordinary people everywhere.
Well, for me, your book came out like one of those fire alarms that has a glass door and a little hammer hanging on a chain beside it to break open in case of fire, because now, after an economy that was wrenched out of shape and a heartbreaking pandemic for many people and nothing done about the climate, the alarm is going off and it is time to wake up. And we repeatedly fail to respond. Do you think we're stuck in a kind of state of shock, almost like a medical shock, where people don't react after an accident?
I think it is a little bit like that. It's a little bit like a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder in a way. I mean, there was a series of different kind of stages of that. I think in a year ago, or just over a year ago, when the WHO, the World Health Organization, declared a a global pandemic and governments kind of rushed to respond to that. We were thrust very quickly into a very strange world, one that we didn't recognize, one that our parents didn't recognize, one that had not been seen really probably in at least 100 years, and one in which we had to respond, I think, from a position of weakness. And that weakness to me was something that I wanted to explore. Why were health systems so unprepared for a pandemic like that? Why were our lives organized in a way that made us particularly vulnerable? Why was it so hard, in fact, to protect the livelihoods of the very people who saved our lives, the nurses, the distribution workers, the carers, the cleaners even at times in a pandemic that spread itself through the surfaces that we touched? And these were the people whose livelihoods had become less and less secure under capitalism over several decades. And to me, you know, that's the point in a way that I want to really bring through as a lesson from this dreadful and often tragic crisis, is that we must and should and indeed can do better in protecting the livelihoods of people who are absolutely central to society, people who in some sense capitalism just forgot.
There's a great story in your book about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's an early candidate for the presidency, and this is of course before his assassination. He goes to the University of Kansas and speaks to a group of young students. And what does he bring out but probably the most boring subject in the world for them, the gross domestic product? Why would he do something so out of place?
You know, that really fascinated me, that story. Why on earth was he talking economics in the first speech of his presidential campaign? Why was he talking about an indicator, this kind of arcane indicator of economic progress in a speech that was supposed to thrust him into the highlight of a quite difficult presidential campaign, because he was standing against an incumbent Democrat president at that time? And the understanding that I had of this, and I traced it through, I followed up actually the person who wrote that speech, a man called Adam Belinsky, and asked him about the circumstances of that, because I was absolutely fascinated by it. Those words that he wrote about the GDP have become a sort of, you know, a flagship speech in some ways for people like me who've been thinking about growth, thinking about the economy, and in particular thinking about the conflict between our economic expansion and the finite nature of our planet, because he articulated exactly that point in 1968, 53 years ago, in a presidential campaign. So I've been fascinated by that speech ever since it was, a recording of it was unearthed from a basement in the university, I think 20 years ago or something. And what Adam Belinsky told me when I was asking him about it was that it spoke to absolutely core concerns that Kennedy had at that time, that he did have a love of the environment, a love of nature. He spent a lot of time in nature as a young man, that he had an absolute concern about social inequality and about the dreadful poverties of not just of material affluence, but actually of meaning and purpose and dignity in America. And he spent a lot of time in that campaign, you know, going around the country, looking at those circumstances, identifying some of the causes of that poverty, and talking to the people who were not the rich and powerful, not the good and the great, not the famous, but actually the ordinary working people of America, and understanding the nature of the malaise that was affecting society at that point in time. 1968 was a tumultuous year. You know, it was comparable in many ways to the year 2020. And Kennedy was an extraordinary presidential candidate. As you mentioned, it was an ill-fated campaign. He was assassinated on the evening of the California primary on the 4th of June. And that promise that he held out of a different kind of politics, a different kind of progress, a real sense of connection to people and a protection of our planet, that had to go into recess for quite a long period of time, partly because, of course, he was cut short in his prime. But it remains for us today, it remains an extraordinary example of vision and foresight, and has much that could teach us, not just how to survive the pandemic, but how to tackle the issues that we face in relation to the environment.
Ah, the America that might have been. You have a serious reputation as an economist in the UK and globally. Are colleagues in your field coming around to Herman Daly's view that the economy is, quote, a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment?
Well, you know, I think they are a bit. I mean, Herman is a, you know, tremendous visionary figure in this field and, you know, fought the ground on which others now can now walk because of what he did in the past. And when he started talking in those terms four more decades ago, it was a difficult territory. Growth was the order of the day. The expansion of the economy was everything. The business of business was business, as the Milton Friedman School, Chicago School, would have said. And to think otherwise was a kind of heresy. And so Herman really did kind of, you know, break that ground back in the day and created the idea that we have to think beyond growth. And I think one of the interesting things and one of the reasons why there is a bigger crowd of people who are prepared to entertain that idea is that in the last 40 or 50 years, growth has subsided. The rate of growth has fallen in advanced economies. The idea that growth can go on forever is no longer something that we can really rely on. So you could say that, you know, if you were in any sense a risk-averse person or someone who had a sense of precaution, you would begin to think about what a post-growth economy might look like, because all of that growth that we took for granted a few decades ago just has not been there, wasn't there even before the pandemic, and may not come back in the form that we, or politicians at least, would like it to do. And economists have been very, very slow to pick that point up, I think. They've been, you know, much more determined to try to keep growth going by loose monetary policy and incentives of one kind and another, and much less observant, I suppose you could say, about the conditions under which we now live. And the conditions of the economy going forward are ones where we do have to pay attention to those who care for us. We do have to think about the structure of our society, and we do have to protect the integrity of our natural resources. Those are all things that suddenly make Herman Daly's idea of a steady state actually a really fascinating place to revisit.
Wall Street and the city are riding high these days, billionaires rising to stratospheric wealth. Isn't it a bit early to be writing about life after capitalism?
Yep, it certainly is. I mean, one of my chapters is called Who Killed Capitalism? And the most obvious answer to that question is nobody. Thank you very much. Capitalism is alive and well. And it's in Wall Street, as you say, and it's in the city in London, and it's in Frankfurt, wherever the financial center of Europe will move to. And it's in Davos, the World Economic Forum. And it's in some senses in the stock market sense of capitalism. It has had a bumper year over the last year, and yet we were faced with fundamental economic difficulties that go right to the heart of that capitalistic economic model, and we haven't found solutions for them yet. In the middle of the crisis, actually, we almost abandoned certain key aspects of capitalism altogether. Governments intervened massively to protect people's lives and to protect people's livelihoods and to build hospitals and to move supply chains that we needed for PPE, the protective equipment that saved the lives of nurses. All of these things, actually, and indeed the money system that allowed them to happen, were things that were essentially almost outlawed in the version of capitalism that preceded this particular crisis. That will change, you know, that we will see actually that our ideological commitment, the narrowing down of our policies to what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, is now in a different place, and we have more options open to us. And I don't know whether that's immediately life after capitalism. As you say, you know, the stock market is really still riding very high off all the money that was pumped in to protect it from the pandemic. But our economy, the basis of our lives, the livelihoods of some of the most important people in society, are still under threat. And capitalism, pure capitalism, I don't think has the answers to that crisis, and that's why I think we have to think beyond it.
Below the layer of the multi-billionaires and the affluent, there are millions of people who feel we have neither prosperity nor growth. They feel shut out. And I wonder, do we still have enough social capital left to plan a new economy and build something? Or will things just spin out of control into hardship and the unknown? What do you think, Tim Jackson?
I believe that we can save that social capital. I think that's, you know, to me, it's not quite an article of faith, but it's certainly a useful place to start from. And it's part, in a way, of what I was trying to do in post-growth was to say, as Kennedy did actually in 1968, that these social values are the things that bind us together, that this social capital is what we build society from, that the idea of social progress is not just about having more and more, and neither are we as a society just a collection of competitive, aggressive, acquisitive individuals. The most important things in our prosperity relate to our health and our relationships and the quality of our lives and the strength of our communities. And actually, again, that was one of the other extraordinary lessons that we learned through the pandemic, is that when things get really difficult, communities can come together. We can reorganize the way that we care for each other. Huge volunteer systems of people supporting each other through the pandemic, providing support to those who are lonely or isolated, bringing care and medicines to those who needed it. I believe those social values still exist, Alex. I don't think that we have managed, even capitalism has not managed to erode them away completely. And I think people's faith in those abilities also remains strong. But that's not to trivialize what you're pointing to, which is this huge sense of alienation, atomization, almost social breakdown and divisiveness that has characterized the lives and the politics of the last few years. And to me, that's the sense of urgency that I have. I believe if we don't confront these issues and find solutions through them and draw on the strength of those social values, then the kind of chaos that you were alluding to is our destiny. But we have a choice there, and that choice is profound, but it offers many, many possibilities for, you know, I think not just as good a world as we had before, but actually one that is far better, because it isn't built on a spurious promise of always having more and more, but allows us the foundation to create more and more meaningful relationships with each other and to redefine our sense of purpose in life. Exactly, in fact, as Kennedy was talking about at the University of Kansas.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the well-known UK ecological economist, Dr. Tim Daxon. In your book, you spend a little time talking about something, labor productivity, and that mystifies most of us. What does it mean?
It is an economic concept, and it's not that easy to grasp, and yet somehow we see its implications all around it. So labor productivity is a measure of how much output, economic output, you can produce as a worker in each hour of your time. And one of the key aspects of capitalism actually is to try and increase that number to make us all more and more productive, to produce more and more things, to make our time more efficient. And there's some places where you can think, well, that's a pretty good thing to do because I don't really, you know, enjoy washing sheets by hand or mixing concrete with a spade. We've got some really nice, clever devices that can do that for us and can lift our lives out of drudgery. And that surely that's got to be a good thing. And then you could take that same principle and you apply it to, you know, the making of things. And you say, well, all the manufacturing needs that we have, wouldn't that be better done with robots? And of course, it might be better, more quickly done with robots. We might be able to produce more things with those robots. And that would mean first of all, more material stuff going through our economy, and secondly, more machines in order to make those material things to go through the economy, and thirdly, less jobs for people. Is that a good thing? And then in another category, you ask the question, well, what about something like care? Is it really a sensible thing to ask all of our nurses to see more and more patients on their nurse round, more doctors to see more people during the day, shorter appointments for everybody? Is it better if we have bigger and bigger class sizes for our teachers to teach? Do we want our craftsmen just to be making shoddy products because it's quicker and they can sell it cheap and it's thrown away soon? Or is it better actually to protect the value of our time in the economy? And this is actually it's a fundamental challenge in capitalist economics. It was identified by an economist, the late William Baumol, who wrote about it over a kind of 30 or 40 year career, and most recently in a book which was subtitled Why Computers Got Cheaper and Healthcare Didn't. And it's because the capitalist economy favors that growth in labor productivity that sits well with making lots of stuff fast, and it doesn't sit well with protecting the time that care workers put into care, that craftsmen put into making beautiful projects, and that our creative artists put into improving the quality of our lives. So all of those sectors that actually are fundamental to the quality of our lives begin to suffer. And that's why something as opaque as labor productivity growth is a really kind of important thing to get our heads around, to understand that that's a structural feature of capitalism that we have to be able to change if we want to address this economy of care that could create a better society.
On another topic, around the world, there's a real estate boom which translates into a housing crisis for many. My kids can never afford to buy a home now. It's just out of reach. And I worry this decade could see a new wave of homelessness.
Things like the housing bubble, you know, tend to be essentially what economists call rent-seeking behavior. We try to squeeze as much value out of other people and out of natural resources as we can by claiming ownership to land, to buildings, to structure, to companies. And this rent-seeking behavior is deeply divisive because it means that those who have access to that property can get very much richer, and those who have no access are, you know, off the property ladder. They have nowhere to start from. The house prices become too high. And when that becomes the basis for our economic success, and we tend to drive it forward with policies that are purely destructive and encouraging that speculative rent-seeking behavior. And it's created actually one of the most worrying divides, or one of the divides that I personally find most worrying, the divide between an older generation that does have a sense of ownership of property and a younger generation who are looking at years of never being able to afford such a luxury. And when you divide the older generation from the younger generation, you begin to divide society itself. So I think that's it's a deeply destructive trend. But it's actually, we have to recognize, I think, that it's a trend that has been to some extent not just allowed, but supported and encouraged by the economic policies that have made the kind of speculative lending that drives up asset prices acceptable in our society. It might be acceptable in purely economic terms. It's totally unacceptable in terms of its social implications. So it's a profound problem that we have to confront, I think, and begin to address.
Some parts of America have a different answer. They're marching sternly toward the past. In Texas, under a new law, you can just buy a gun without a permit or any background check and strap it on your waist and go out shopping like it's the old West. And we see leanings towards more authoritarian governments in some Eastern EU states even. So I'm wondering if we try to go back towards the past because the future seems impossible.
I don't think it works out well for us. That's my fear. And to some extent, I would say that much of my work is motivated by that fear and by a sense that there is actually a much better world. There's a better sense of prosperity. There's a better sense of who we are as human beings that doesn't see us as purely competitors in a vicious struggle for existence, but sees us as collaborators in the relationships that form society, and that actually through that different vision of ourselves, I believe we can achieve a better quality of life, a richer quality of life. It may not be one in which everybody can aspire to be those billionaires that you spoke of earlier who have profited so well from the crisis. It may not be a world full of Elon Musks and Jeff Bezoses. It may not be a world in which we all consume and see our sole purpose as being consumption. But to my mind, that is an anxiety-ridden, pathological place of denial that capitalism has forced upon us. It has reduced our expectations of what it means to be human. It hasn't enriched them. And I feel profoundly that actually beyond what appear to us to be limits in terms of material things, there is an almost unlimited territory in terms of the expansion of the human spirit, of human potential, that we can access actually quite profound states of satisfaction through activity, through engaging our skills in meeting challenges, through being fulfilled through our work and through our relationships, and sometimes even through very simple activities like exercise and contemplation and meditation. And that this huge breadth of human experience is itself being curtailed by the dream of having more and more material stuff. And while that dream is, you know, it's very understandable, and it's particularly understandable for the poorest in society, after a certain point, it just leads us astray, and it becomes a distraction from this richer land, which I fully believe actually is the ultimate goal of human progress, to expand our potential, to expand our horizons, to expand our consciousness, to expand our care for other people, and in doing so, actually to find out what it means to be human. And that in a way is a, you know, it's a very powerful vision, because it isn't restricted by class or gender or color. It isn't restricted by your income. It is actually a place where everybody has, and I believe everybody has the right to, the ability to see growth, if you like, of a different kind, of a kind that expands our humanity and that creates a world in which, in fact, everybody has the ability to flourish as human beings.
We are starting to run out of time, so I've just got two quick questions for you. The first is degrowth not in your toolbox for post-growth solutions?
I think the work of the degrowth community has been profoundly useful, and it has placed the question of growth firmly in the headlights, and I think that's a very good thing. I prefer the term post-growth, partly because I think we're already there, and partly because it has a sense, actually, that possibility of a life after capitalism that isn't reliant on growth can be that richer place that I was describing. And I think many of the people who talk about degrowth would agree with that.
Yes, their emphasis is on well-being, and that is what you were talking about as well. Where do you see yourself going next, Tim?
A couple of places, I guess. One is identifying these structural difficulties within capitalism really focuses your mind on how little we know about an economy that doesn't work in that way. So my research center actually in the UK and the work that we've been doing there has really been trying to articulate that question of what this post-growth economy looks like. How does it operate? How does ownership work in it? How do debts work in it? How does the government work in it? What's the relationship between our investment and our consumption? You know, deeply economic questions, which aren't everybody's cup of tea by any means, but actually are quite fundamental to thinking about the economy that we want in the future. And the second, I think, is driven really by my passionate belief in this better, richer, deeper sense of what it means to be human. So it's more of a psychological, social project. And possibly also, you know, to refer back to my hobby, as you described it, of writing, an artistic project, because it is art that gives us the tools through which we can explore the vision for a better future. And that I think is a tremendously important task.
We've been speaking with author, playwright, and major economist Professor Tim Jackson. He directs the Center for Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. Tim's new book just out is Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. Find links for Tim Jackson and his work at timjackson.org.uk and more of my review at ecoshock.org. Tim, we really appreciate sharing time with you. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Can we humans plan to avoid a catastrophe of our own making? Shall we redefine the future or wait until disasters rule us? A reduction of human numbers and impact seems inevitable either way. Two young scientists look at the pathway that the United Nations and national governments refuse to consider. Manfred Lenzen is professor of sustainability research at the University of Sydney. His partner and lead author is Lawrence Kaiser. Lawrence specializes in environmental systems and policy at ETH Zurich. They explain the challenges and need for degrowth to really keep global climate change below 2 degrees C. From Zurich, Switzerland, Lawrence Kaiser, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, all my life, Lawrence, every expert, politician, and talking head, they sell me on growth. Business wants to sell more, institutions want to grow, people want bigger houses and cars. When we are this deep into the growth model of how everything is supposed to work, Lawrence, how can we begin to think about living the opposite?
I totally understand this thing because indeed, many things, if we look around us, they point into this direction of more and more growth and consumption and production, etc. But I think there are still many things or ways to start to think about something else. And first of all, I think it's important to emphasize that degrowth, in this sense, is not the opposite of growth. It really means something different in this sense. It implies reduced energy and material consumption, and in this sense, less consumption and production overall. But it also means changing the way the economy works, how our systems provide for us in terms of well-being. And in this sense, it really focuses a lot on increasing equality, focusing on well-being and democracy, really. And in this sense, it really is fundamentally different to just increasing more or reducing this consumption. In this sense, it's really about emancipating people, coming together, choosing less or working less in this sense. So how do we begin to think about this? I think there are really many hopeful things which we can detect if we look around in our daily lives. People, you know, choosing to work less, spend less money and instead spend more time with friends and family to repair things, care for loved ones, having a garden, you know, or pensioners committed to community work. And also people's movements, like protesting for climate justice in the Sunrise Movement or for a Green New Deal in the U.S., and also even Black Lives Matter. These are all things which resonate, you know, with the call for global socio-ecological justice, which degrowth stands for.
You know, it seems to me for a while, from my perspective in North America at least, degrowth was a bigger movement. In 2010, I recorded and broadcast a degrowth conference in Vancouver. There were international conferences in Paris and Barcelona. We heard less, I thought, but now degrowth is rising again. Lawrence, why do you think that is?
I'm not particularly familiar with the history of degrowth in the U.S., but at least from my perspective in Europe, it wasn't really gone. I mean, it's a very young concept. It only originated sort of the English word degrowth or sustainable degrowth, the concept sustainable degrowth, only originated in 2001. And the first academic conference on the topic, which sort of brought the concept into the scientific discussion, was in 2008 in Paris. sort of in the same year, 2008-2009, the global financial crisis happened, and this helped propose this concept to more and more people, because it really sort of showed that the criticisms of degrowth weren't quite wrong, right? They showed that sort of this system based on perpetual growth really has its issues and crises, which in the end failed people. And with time, you know, more and more people came to experience the concept and get to know it. 2014 was the conference in Leipzig in Germany with really thousands of people. And it seems that sort of the concept gained in popularity since then, also because we sort of see the crisis worsen, standard approaches not being enough. A few countries have reduced carbon emissions, but not nearly enough as we would need. So all these things showing that there might be something correct about the analysis that the degrowth movement is proposing. So more and more social movements taking up the idea. As I said, Sunrise or also the Fridays for Future movement, climate strikes, but also other movements focusing on living better with less, such as the Transition Towns movement or generally downshifting and minimalism. All these things grew in popularity, and I think this is one of the reasons why it's gaining in popularity, because its analysis proves more and more correct in this sense, and now also COVID has shown again sort of that care, labor, and healthy relationships to ecosystems are really crucial, and these are two things that degrowth really focuses on too.
But why do you say degrowth needs a movement? I mean, couldn't a dictator or even a president during a crisis just order reduced consumption and less energy be used? Why do we need a movement?
First of all, again, I think degrowth really is more than just less production and consumption. In the degrowth concept, which we discuss, it's really the focus on more democratic systems where people collectively come together and decide on the limits they want to impose and to enable freedom within these limits. In this sense, you probably could have a dictator imposing limits, but it would be a miserable and highly unequal experience. Because in the end, who would this dictator exclude? Who would he favor? All these discussions would probably not be taken into account. And it would most likely not be accepted by people. You know, we see this right now with COVID measures, where people really criticize undemocratic procedures and do not accept the measures, which in the end leads to more dead people. And therefore, sort of, degrowth really focuses on enabling more people participating in the decisions which affect them, also in order to increase the acceptance and to lead to these cultural and value changes which are necessary for everyone to have a good life with less material consumption, because otherwise people will just experience it as top-down imposed against their will, and this is not what degrowth stands for.
I totally agree. I don't think it'll work unless people are willing to make the changes. You can't force this. Now, getting to climate, the only climate organization recognized by governments is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the so-called Conference of the Parties. Have either of these considered or studied degrowth as part of the big solution for global warming?
Maybe implicitly. There is a big role for reducing material and energy consumption. For instance, in the 2018 special report on the 1.5 degree target by the IPCC, there was the low energy demand scenario, this is the name, which drastically reduces material and energy consumption and thereby leading to less ambitious increases in terms of renewable energy and also negative emission technologies. But it never features sort of explicitly. And also in this scenario, in the low energy demand scenario, I have to add, this is combined with increasing global growth in consumption and production. So this is not really a degrowth scenario. So there is not an explicit discussion of degrowth in the IPCC, and this was the starting point also for our paper, because we wanted to look at the potential of degrowth in addressing the challenges which we face in mitigating climate change, and which we saw here was overlooked.
Okay, well, before we get too deep, Lawrence, let's be real. Are we talking about an interesting, admirable theory like science fiction? Or do you and Manfred really believe degrowth could happen?
I personally can't speak for my co-author, Manfred Lenzen, but I personally believe it can happen in this direction here in Europe and from afar, also a little in the U.S. So I really think that this has potential and it can change things for the better. But we definitely need a lot more people working and thinking on this.
Well, the only case of national degrowth I can remember was in the early 1990s when the former Soviet Union collapsed, production crashed, greenhouse gas emissions fell sharply, and so did life expectancy for people in Russia. Is that degrowth?
This is exactly not degrowth. This is sort of decline by disaster, really, and exactly the scenario, actually, which degrowth wants to avoid, because it really defines itself in terms of maintaining well-being while reducing the environmentally harmful activities. So this is really the best counterexample for degrowth, really a crash, unplanned, unorganized, undemocratic in this sense, and really not focusing on the things that matter for people.
I guess a similar case, official figures say global economic activity fell about 4% during the pandemic year of 2020. Did we just get a taste of degrowth there?
Exactly. Also here, degrowth was often sort of conflated with this recession. Really, this is the correct term for this, an unplanned reduction in economic activity. And really, degrowth tries to address these processes by, you know, focusing on policies and changes that improve people's lives, maintain employment, and, for instance, guarantee people access to the services they need, healthcare, transport, etc., to really reduce this anxiety people have from facing a recession. This is really designed to prevent these effects.
Remember, you can listen to all past Radio EcoShock programs absolutely free at our website, ecoshock.org. You don't have to sign in or sign up. Just click to listen, or you can download the audio of all our expert guests, ecoshock.org. So in 2020, 1,100 experts and over 70 organizations from 60 countries published an open letter calling for degrowth as the way forward from the COVID-19 crisis. Instead, a lot of governments denounced huge spending to restore the growth economy. What could we be doing instead, Lawrence?
There are many, many things which could be done differently. I think there were also other open letters published proposing exactly different changes, which differ exactly from these huge spending to restore GDP growth. Instead, we could really have a discussion, an open discussion in our societies about what's really important for us and how we want to go forward to live together. I'm pretty sure that this would result in very different measures, for instance, focused on a Green New Deal without growth, investing heavily in renewable energy and having the discussion, you know, what do we want to invest in? Then focus on what really matters for people, you know, implementing working time reductions, fostering care work in the education and healthcare sector, for instance, or introducing a universal basic income. These discussions, which now sound far removed, but are partly implemented in different contexts worldwide already, could work really well to improve people's lives while reducing the impact on the environment. Not a return back to normal, but would be maybe a better scenario.
What about green growth, Lawrence? Is that the same or different than degrowth?
It's certainly different to degrowth. It's sort of the currently dominant or mainstream approach to talking about or addressing environmental issues, which means that sort of we try to make economic growth increases in GDP compatible with environmental sustainability, for instance, by investing in renewable energy and energy efficiency. These investments are also often thought to spur economic growth, sort of to combine having jobs and the environment. This is very different to degrowth, because degrowth really says that, you know, what's important for people's happiness and well-being, especially in rich countries in the global north, is not more GDP growth. It doesn't really correlate anymore with these measures of quality of life. And instead, we should really focus on the things that matter in terms of environmental sustainability without regarding GDP growth as a goal, and just implement these things which are right in these dimensions. And if, you know, if GDP declines, then that's okay, because it really isn't what matters to people. It's very different to green growth.
We have to be able to ask the hard questions, and one of them is, could the transition to renewables actually increase economic growth and all the problems that come with that?
Definitely. If we invest in renewable energy, this will feature in GDP as an increase. However, the question is whether we could do this fast enough and extensively enough to really meet the climate targets, especially where 1.5 degrees are well below 2 degrees. And there, you know, current evidence really suggests that this is not feasible, not possible. Not taking into account, you know, all the issues around rare earth metal extraction and the conflicts which arise from that. And here the evidence really suggests that this is most likely not possible, especially if we take into account equity concerns, which really show that richer people and countries really have a deep responsibility to reduce even faster. Still, why should we focus on GDP growth, which includes things which actually harm people? Like if we have more car accidents and we need to buy more cars and repair more cars, then this features positively in GDP growth. So this is really a goal which should be questioned a lot more than it is currently. And then we would focus on different things. Also on increasing renewable energy, for sure, but also other things which make it a lot easier to decarbonize, for instance, questioning luxury consumption, such as private jets from billionaires. You know, these are all things which we could question and decarbonize much, much faster in terms of just replacing coal power with renewable energy is much easier than replacing current aviation with renewable fuels. So this could really speed up decarbonization a lot.
Before the pandemic struck, this civilization was already driving hard towards a collapse for a long list of reasons. Now I hear politicians and media and everybody around me saying, let's get back to normal. But that was heading for disaster normal. How can we communicate the possibilities of a simpler life, stepping lightly on the earth, and is that what you are partly proposing?
Yes, I think really the saying fits well. You know, the rich must live more simply in order for everyone else to simply live. This simpler life in terms of material services is one goal or element of degrowth. But I think what degrowth does well, also in choosing this term really, which evokes usually rather negative associations with people, is to argue that this can actually really be something positive, you know, that this does not mean that we go back to living in caves, but the caves in which we are going to live, they have internet, they are well heated, they have transport for everyone, healthcare, education, etc. So this is really high living standards maintained with a lot lower energy consumption and consumption overall. And this is really, I think, the core communicational asset of degrowth, to turn something currently negative into really aspirational goal and something positive to look forward to. This is in part what degrowth is proposing, to live simpler but better. I would really stress that this also incorporates, you know, addressing current power structures and changing the economic system and not only focusing, you know, on the individual here, but because everyone also really faces a lot of obstacles to doing this. You know, not everyone can buy organic food and et cetera. And it's wrong, I think, to reduce sustainability to that.
To be honest, though, Lawrence, your paper is difficult. It's not one that I could just say to listeners, well, go read this paper, because you're dealing with so many variables. The whole trying to see the future, it's really complex. For example, you say a focus on well-being instead of economic production is essential to growing smaller in a positive way. Why do we have to consider that when we're looking at the big economy and where we want to go?
This focus on well-being is really a crucial part of degrowth, because currently the focus is not directly on well-being, on satisfying human needs around education, transport, and food, and also discussing, you know, what are these needs really and how can we satisfy them in a way that's not detrimental to our livelihood. Currently, we are not focusing on well-being. We focus on GDP growth, on maintaining profits for companies, on maintaining jobs, of course, because if we are lacking growth currently, this means more unemployment. So the question degrowth asks really, how can we decouple well-being from growth, and how can we have the education, the healthcare, and all that while even if GDP declines? And this is sort of the key task, because oftentimes what we see is that focusing on GDP growth really prevents the necessary action in terms of climate mitigation, you know, that we don't introduce the incredibly high carbon taxes or carbon fee and dividends, because this is feared to have a negative impact on growth and leading to job losses, etc. So degrowth proposes, you know, just focus on the things that are well-being and introduce the ecological measures, and we will be fine, but even if GDP declines in the process. So I really think this focus on well-being is absolutely crucial to tackling the environmental crisis which we currently face.
On this program, we had Timothy Garrett from the University of Utah. He explained his formula showing energy and gross domestic product are intimately tied together. It's not a simple formula, but it does work on historic data. And Garrett shows that with energy and production, if you increase one or decrease one, the other follows in the same direction. Have you encountered Garrett's work?
I have encountered Timothy Garrett, I think, only via Twitter. Not so much his academic work, but I think his thesis, which sort of aims at, as you said, the connection between economic growth and energy consumption, is very prominent also in our paper. And we therefore focus a lot on how sort of energy efficiency gains, for instance, often lead to economic growth and thus, again, to more energy consumption, which supports this thesis that GDP growth and energy growth develop in the same direction, which is, as you said, also what we observe empirically.
A recent article in the New York Times cites a series of authorities predicting surprising population decline. I'm not sure that I believe it, but that's what they say. Would degrowth of the human population itself help our battle to preserve a livable planet? What do you think?
In our paper, we really didn't focus on population growth. And this is due to some reasons, I think, because first of all, many other papers, publications show that although population growth is a factor in environmental impacts, it's by far not the dominant one, which is sort of affluence or per capita consumption, really, which we can also see in the distribution of global carbon emissions. Between 1990 and 2015, the global top 1% income earners were responsible for twice as much cumulative carbon as the poorest half of humanity, right? So this is really huge disparities there. And really, as you said, that globally increasing rates of population are slowing down. And it's certainly, in this sense, making things easier for environmental targets. But we really think that to address this issue, we should more or less avoid talking about population growth, because it is itself a quite risky concept, because it directly invokes the question who is too much, you know, which populations, and it's easily sort of the doorway for more racist or anti-immigrant positions. And in this sense, we should focus more on what matters for population growth, which is women's emancipation and empowerment, and also affluence, sort of how rich these populations are. Here we can really focus, you know, on family planning and education, particularly for women. In this sense, has a lot of co-benefits, right? It really is unquestionably just, and we don't risk other talking points, which can be problematic, but really focusing on the things that matter, like women's emancipation and more equal distributions of power and incomes and et cetera, can really lead to much bigger outcomes, avoiding the negative issues which are associated with population growth.
Final question. Tell us about the climate protest you attended recently.
This was last Friday, which was the national climate strike or climate protest here in Switzerland, organized by the climate strike movement, which originated sort of from the Fridays for Future youth climate movement. It was a very rainy day. We were hours out there in the rain, but with thousands of people here in Zurich, and it was really a great atmosphere, and yeah, really making a lot of hope for positive change in the future. This was really great experience, and good to sort of bring the results of science directly through the application of the protest. This was really great.
We have been with Lawrence Kaiser, a student at ETH Zurich. He leads the new paper titled 1.5 Degrees Degrowth Scenarios Suggest the Need for New Mitigation Pathways, as published in Nature Communications, May 11, 2021. Find links to the paper and further research geared to listeners in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Lawrence, thank you for helping us grow a little less.
Thanks so much for having me and the interesting questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highway of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities, and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.